holding up all right? Some of you that are new, it's hard to get used to it. Are you going to hold up? Those who have been doing this for a while, you don't realize how strong your sense of yoga has become. This is a yoga of civilization. It's very, very, very strong. Some of you are incredibly capacious. I'm very happy for you. Human cultural scenes divide themselves into subgroups. And the splits do not occur at random, but occur along structural lines. Those structural lines appear in the mind. Those structural lines are movements in the social realm, which is man in nature, and etch. They're like an acid that etches the actual structure of the brain. There's a beautiful illustration in The Science of Mind that was published by MIT Press in 1989. We know enough about brain structure now, and they have on facing pages a European brain and a Japanese brain. And the language structures are in different parts of the brain. We're not conditioned by nature. Mother Nature loves us to be free. She wants us free. The mind isn't conditioned by the brain. Brains are not standard army issue. But brains have to receive what's going on the way it goes on. It's a sensitive emulsion, and it has to receive what's going on the way it's actually going on. So that, in a very real way, it's almost like Plotinus again. The mind projects out and makes the world seen, and the world seeing etches its pattern, the mind's secret pattern, on the brain, and out of that comes a kind of rote habitual activity. And if you're not into the sphericality of things, you think that you learned it from the world. Well, that's not true at all. That has never been true. We're not little imitation replicas of materiality. That's not the truth at all. That's like sex, lies, and videotape. That's just not, that's a transparent illusion. But only by getting to a structural, visionary penetration can one come to understand, it's like the beginnings of philosophy. That's it. That's what is actually going on here. That the ecology includes a lot of phases that you habitually didn't pay any attention to and so thought didn't exist or didn't count. The only culture that has preserved the interchangeable quality of the moieties intact into the modern world is the Chinese. Traditional Chinese society preserved intact right up until our own time. Not only the dual structure, yin and yang, but the fact that they interchange all the time, and that's what is real about them is change. That the wholeness of the two is in how they make a unity of zero. But it's not the zero of nothing, of canceling each other out, but it's the zero of absolute balance. The best way that this is expressed, and the traditional way in Chinese learning that this is expressed, is to go to the Tao Te Ching. And I'm using this translation that just came out. Lao Tzu, the Te Tao Ching. I think Chatterton's has copies. It's only in hardcover so far. About $20, $19.95. This is a translation of Lao Tzu made from the texts that were found about 10 years ago in a tomb in China. They're called the Ma Wan Tui texts. And when they opened up this tomb, archaeologically, they found texts from 300 BC of the Tao Te Ching, which are more than 1,000 years older than any of the other known texts. So in a way, these are like Chinese Dead Sea Scrolls. And one can see that the first thing that happened in Chinese Neo-Confucian times is that the order of the Tao Te Ching was reversed. They didn't dare throw the Tao section out and keep only the section on Te. Te means virtue, but often is translated socially as power. Power. What does blinded material man want? Power. You give me the power and you have the rest, because if I have the power, I'll get the rest from you. But in the Chinese tradition, the way was always preserved with power, so that Tao and Te always were paired together. It's not only that Lao Tzu, in his genius, paired them together, but that traditional Chinese wisdom, going back many thousands of years, always understood you have to keep this pair together, because one without the other is going to be nothing but jeopardy and peril for men. In the Tao Te Ching, the 42nd chapter, what has been labeled as the 42nd chapter, these labelings of chapters happened about the 2nd century AD of our era. Here's how it reads. The way gave birth to the one. The one gave birth to the two. The two gave birth to the three. And the three gave birth to the 10,000 things. The 10,000 things carry yin on their backs and wrap their arms around yang. Through the blending of qi, they arrive at a state of harmony. You can pronounce that qi, if you like, or qi. I learned G, so I use G. Through the blending of G, they arrive in a state of harmony. This is the five-phase energy cycle in classical Taoism, classical Chinese Taoism. This five-phase energy cycle is linked together by a movement, and the movement is G. So the G is like the Euclidean line. You can diagram it by drawing a line, but that's not what it is. It is simply pure movement. It is, in fact, precisely the pure movement of a focus. And if you don't have the focus to begin with, then the movement is not pure. And you don't have any G. You don't have any structure. You don't have any psychic energy structure at all. And if you don't have any psychic energy structure, you're never going to have a symbolic self, because the pattern won't manifest. So that you never will actually be. You'll only reflect as a mirror somebody else's idea of what you should be. And that may be ill-founded or may even be unfounded. But no matter how well-founded it is, it's still not you in your pristine thusness. And one of the basic things in the Bill of Rights in this universe is you have a right to be who you are. That's guaranteed. And it's always a travesty if someone else takes that right from you and assumes it on themselves. It doesn't matter if it's another person, or if it's a culture, or on what level. You can assent to that later on if you want to, but you have the right to be who you are. Now, in the Tao Te Ching, and if you get a copy of this, eventually we'll be working with the Tao Te Ching also. The Tao Te Ching is an insight line. The whole thing about the Tao Te Ching is that it's an insight line. It's like in ancient Chinese astronomy, when you sight along a line for a star, the star in the heavens that doesn't move, we call that star Polaris. So that the whole of Chinese astronomy is that there is a world axis coming down from Polaris. And all the other sightings are vectors off that central axis. But if you're to use a phrase of moving your mind from star to star up here, the Chinese phrase translates as pacing the void. Very interesting. Because it means that you, from your perspective, are not a secondary figure, but you are the mobile relationality which is real for all the stars. It is you who can pace the void. The stars have to stay where they are, but you can pace the void. So there is a conversion. The sight line that comes down to you, you are on the pole along with Polaris. Polaris is the pole of the heavens, and you, if you're the true person, you're the pole of the earth. And all the sight lines move from you. And you have that yang capability of movement. We'll get into this, and there's more to it. The Tao Te Ching is a sight line, and the heavens which it sights is the I Ching. So the I Ching is the celestial dome of images. The 64 hexagrams are the starry expanse of this celestiality, and the Tao Te Ching is a sight line of the true person to this heaven as a whole, the I Ching as a whole, or to any hexagram, any star within it. So if you know how to use the Tao Te Ching as a sight line, you're able to pace the void of the I Ching pretty well. There's a whole different dimension of understanding this. Now, the only person in town who probably could teach this, if he would be Master Ni. But generally, he's retired from teaching life. Now, my mentor, Gaiyushu, was on a par with Master Ni, and I'll give you as best I can an insight into this material so that you can use it in terms of itself, of its own nature. We had, at the very first session, if you remember, in the I Ching, and now we're moving to the I Ching. We had Thoreau, and we moved to anthropology for a little bit, and we moved to the Tao Te Ching, and now we're moving to the I Ching. We're developing a field of inquiry, and we're developing it as fast as you can possibly take it. In the I Ching, we began at the center. Instead of looking at the hexagrams, we're not going to look at the hexagrams for a while. We began with the Zhougua, which is the discussion of the trigrams on page 262. And if you got a chance, you should have been able to look at in the last 2 weeks, from page 262 to page 279. Now the next sequence to look at is the structure of the hexagrams, which is page 356. And it goes over, let's see how far, 365. From the structure of the trigrams to the structure of the hexagrams. But in order to make the transition from the trigrams to the hexagrams, this is a big jump. It's not just a jump from 8 to 64, but notice that there is a geometrical relationality between 8 and 64. What is the relation? It's a doubling. It's a multiplication. 8 times 8 is 64. So you're moving a whole order in conceptual power. You're moving from 8 to 8 squared. This is a tremendous jump. It's a tremendous leap. To move from 8 to 8 squared is really a quantum jump in human capacity. It sustained Chinese civilization right up to the 20th century, because the next movement, to move to 8 cubed, is such an enormous undertaking that it almost boggles the imagination. In fact, in terms of plain geometry, it would boggle the imagination. There's almost no one around who's capable of moving to 8 cubed, except with a really refined consciousness and all kinds of computer tools. Then you can move to 8 cubed. And 8 cubed would be called in contemporary language hyperspace. It would be a trigonometric functionality of the trigrams, which would be an asymptotic jump in terms of our consciousness to where this leads. Nobody's done 8 cubed so far. But moving from 8 to 8 squared required a transformational pattern. You can't just move from 8 to 8 squared. You can't move from the trigrams to the hexagrams. The hexagrams are not made by adding up. They're made by a generative process, so that the trigrams, instead of being statically there, begin to occur as a matrix. In order to have generation, you can't have just a static thingness there, but you have to have a dynamic quality to it, which requires a transformational vehicle, which means some kind of symbolic pattern which is capable of affecting that transformation. So the transformation from the trigrams to the hexagrams required a symbolic pattern. And the pattern appears on page 309 of the standard Wilhelm Baines I Ching of Princeton. This pattern is called Ho-Tu, or sometimes it's called the Yellow River Map. So that, and there's another expression of it on page 310, but the one on 309. So if you're looking at this, and I'll try and have this for you next week, you need to lay out on your table a sequence. 1, 2, 3. The first sequence are the 8 trigrams. The second sequence is this Yellow River map. And the third sequence is that of the hexagrams. Now, when you lay it out in this fashion on the table, you have before you a diagram which has the middle three elements in this five-phase energy cycle. In other words, if you bring the 42nd chapter of the Tao Te Ching in as a template now. Antonioni, the Italian filmmaker, used to carry around a 35mm slide frame. It didn't have any picture in it, just the frame. And he used to, from time to time, hold the thing up. You're always looking around, kind of, and hold it up. Because that's the way that he could creatively see. Oh, man, like that. This 42nd chapter of the Tao Te Ching is something like that. And now we're going to hold it up. It's like a template, frame of reference, to these three stages, which are the middle, 2, 3, 4 stages in a 5-stage sequence. In other words, there's a stage called the Tao that isn't on the table, but counts. You have to count it. It's a zero. But the trigrams are the stage of one. The Yellow River map is the stage of two. And the hexagrams are the stage of three. And the fifth stage is what you do with it. What you do with it. So if you lay those three pages, those three stages on your desk, and you bring yourself into relationship with them, you have a working model of what the 42nd chapter of the Tao Te Ching is conveying to us. And you have, maybe for the first time in your life, you have an overview of a complete energy cycle. Notice that what completes the energy cycle, what makes it an ecology of mind, to use a phrase that was developed in the 1960s. What makes that an ecology of mind is your ability to make the fifth stage factor into the first stage without anything left over. If what you do is able to be factored back into the Tao with nothing missing and nothing left over, then you have a pure energy cycle. Then you have the circulation of the Qi. Then you have the dynamic, which when it manifests its fullness, is the golden flower. That's what it is. It's right there in that. This gives us a chance to use the Chinese genius here in our program to get a glimpse of something which can only be alluded to elegantly in Thoreau, brilliantly in Boas, and somewhat precariously in the way that I'm using. But this gives you a chance to do that. Okay, we're going to set the I Ching aside like we did Thoreau. And we're going to set Boas aside. We're going to set Kroeber aside. We've got two more elements in churning our field of inquiry. Very briefly. I won't keep you. Just very, very briefly. If you look at our program, you notice that the portable Thoreau and the I Ching are texts. But there's a third book here called Origins. It's in paperback. I've got an old hardcover version. And I'm going to talk more about this next week. Richard Leakey, who is the son of Louis Leakey. And the real important figure here is Louis Leakey. Louis Leakey is like Boas or Kroeber or Sir James George Frazer. Louis Leakey is the one who had the vision. His son is a second generation who carries it out. But there's kind of like a little bit of a snag here, which you have to see it. It's like an arcaneness which is very mysterious, and if you're not an insider in a way, there's no way that you know that this actually happens. In a way, Richard Leakey is not patterning himself after his father, but is patterning himself after his mother. Louis Leakey had the vision But Richard Leakey doesn't learn the vision from his father. He could not have learned it from his father. He could care less about his father. He didn't want to be in this field. He tried everything to do something else. He didn't want to follow in the old man's footsteps because he couldn't. Because the old man was a one of a kind. No one can follow someone like Louis Leakey. Louis Leakey's own biography is entitled White Africa. When he went away to England and was studying at Cambridge, he used to dream in the African language that he grew up with, Kikuyu. He never dreamed in English. He dreamed in Kikuyu. He was an African. He's not a white man. I mean, he was a white man physiologically, but his mind was an African mind. That's why he was so at home in a primordial, as we would say, mystical way in the landscape, because he was an African. When he was in Kenya, he was perfectly at home, but at home to the extent that he had never, ever left there for maybe millions of years, which is why he could look around and he could penetrate and see what nobody else even suspected could be there. It took him 25 years to find the first piece. He found a tooth that came from somebody about 2 million years ago in Africa. He was the only person alive who could have seen that. Because sometimes, on this level, it's very occult. You can't see it until your consciousness is capable of seeing it. And you have to refine your consciousness to that point to be able to see it, and then you do see it. And if you want to use a fairy tale here, it's fine with me. It wasn't there until you could see it. When you could see it, then it was there. And it was there in such an indelible way that it was there in tandem with your capacity to see it, and the two were looking for each other at that moment. But Richard Leakey couldn't follow his father, he followed his mother, Mary Leakey. And when you get to it, you'll see that Mary Leakey is indeed an incredible human being. She's like Jane Ellen Harrison. She's like Gladys Reinscheid, Margaret Mead, or Ruth Benedict. She understood the vision, but she could do it. She could make the nourishment. She could serve it up in such a way that her son could learn. The visionary is very often not the best teacher. But someone who understands the visionary is the best teacher. The archetype of this is that Moses is unable to speak. His brother Aaron has to do the speaking. It's an archetypal structure. Sometimes the visionary is not the one that can control it. But somebody who is close, they can convey it. Because they're not, the visionary sometimes is almost electrocuted by divine fire if they try to speak the whole truth. Because they're plugged in, they're connected. And if you open up the circuits, you can get crashed easily. But the person next to them is the one that can teach you. Mary Leakey is the teacher of Richard Leakey. She's the one that brought out the fact that he was incredibly a genius at finding these archaic fossil remnants. And Mary Leakey used to go out all by herself except for her pack of dogs. She had about 12, 15 dogs that she loved. And she would go out with her dogs. And she went out for 25 years by herself with the dogs. Because she believed her husband's vision. She knew that that vision was truthful because he was truthful. She knew that he was truthful, and she knew that if he has a vision of wholeness that comes out of his truthfulness, that vision is also true. But she was the one who later on found most of the materials and put the thing together. She gave that finding capacity to her son. He learned it from her. So that one time he was flying in a plane with some friends, coming back after having been gone away someplace for a long time. And they're flying over the African landscape, and Richard Leakey looks down and he sees a kind of a protuberance jutting into what now is Lake Turkana. And he knew that that's the place. And he said, put the plane down, put the plane down. They landed on the lake bed, and within about an hour, he had found part of a fossil of someone about 4 million years old. And it's proved to be one of the great sites, Kubi Fora. I've got the volumes here, the archaeological volumes published by Oxford on it. He knew it instantly. There it is. Because he got that from the mother. Because the mother, it's almost like a fairy tale. The mother, in accepting the vision of her man, was able to pass on that vision in the acceptance mode to the son. It's a very mysterious process. So that when you come, for instance, to the I Ching, and you come to where the Yellow River map is, you'll notice that at the top it's called the Ta Chuan, the Great Treatise. Ta means big or great. Chuan means a treatise or a little booklet, pamphlet. That the Yellow River map exists here in the Ta Chuan, the Great Treatise. And that one of the central notions here is that somehow the trigrams, in order to transform into the hexagrams in an effective human way, had to be conceived of as a family. That there was a mother trigram, and there was a father trigram, and then there were 6 children trigrams, split into boys and girls equally. Eldest son, middle son, youngest son. Eldest daughter, middle daughter, youngest daughter. One of the effects of making conscious the moiety of the process, of the whole of the process in the Yellow River map, was then to express that moiety in a family structure, and that's how the trigrams were able then to imprint all of their symbolic value into the hexagrams. And I use the imprint, it's just like imprinting. It's just like the studies of Conrad Lorenz with ducks. As soon as the little ducklings break out, the first creature they see is the mother. And it doesn't matter what species the creature is, that's mother. He became mother to a whole lot of ducks and geese and so forth, and he was their mother. He understood that they had imprinted him. He's their mother. And he had to teach them how to eat and the whole thing. Because there is reality, actually exists. And at that moment, when the real occurs, whatever is really happening, that's what becomes real. Knowing that, one is very, very circumspect and very cautious not to do wrong. Notice that there's a difference between a moral basis of action, which somebody else tells you you should do, and an ethical basis, which you know this is the right way. There's no way that any sentient being is going to transgress an ethic, because they understand that it's indelible. There's no way that you're going to do wrong if you know on the deep self basis. No way whatsoever. We're generating a field of inquiry. Notice the interpenetration of the materials. Now in Origins, I would like you to look at page 43 and page 44. This is in the section on the roots of humanity. Page 43 has hands, And page 44 has eyes. Okay? Hands and eyes go together. Hands and eyes go together. Richard Leakey singles out two modes from the hand which go together. One is the power grip, and the other is the precision grip. They're almost like metaphors for feeling, which is comprehensive and powerful, and thought, which is precise and elegant. I won't say delicate because that has derisive connotation. The hand, in these two modes, also cues in vision. Vision is able to be precise. You're able to focus on objects. That's how you see. But it also is powerful. It can gestalt the whole spectrum. There's a power look, and there's a precision look with eyes. But not only do the eyes look out powerfully and precise, but they can also turn around and look within powerfully and precise. We need to know that. We need to know that that is true of us too. And there is no one who is so insignificant they do not have this capacity, this universal capacity, to see within powerfully and precisely at the same time. So now you can see that our field of inquiry is generated. The last item, I want to start some of you on the Odyssey, and because we're reading it for a whole year, I want to start with just the first few lines of book one, and then we'll stop for today. This is how the Odyssey begins. I'm using the Richmond Lattimore translation. Remember, the Odyssey is a feminine journey. Moby Dick is a masculine journey. The Odyssey is a feminine journey. Homer wrote, "Tell me, Muse, of the man of many ways, who has driven far journeys after he had sacked Troy's sacred citadel. Many were they whose cities he saw, whose minds he learned of, many the pains he suffered in his spirit on the wide sea, struggling for his own life and the homecoming of his companions. Even so, he could not save his companions, hard though he strove to. They were destroyed by their own wild recklessnesses. Fools who devoured the oxen of Helios, the sun god, and he took away the day of their homecoming. From some point here, goddess, daughter of Zeus, speak and begin our story." That's how it begins. Notice here, there are already two feminine figures operative here. One is the muse of epic poetry. There were nine muses who were focused and became Apollo. Or, when Apollo resonated wholly, his resonance was the nine muses. The nine muses plus Apollo is the perfect ten, Pythagorean wise. One of the muses is the muse of epic poetry, and her name was Calliope. So Homer appeals to Calliope to begin, but she's the overall condition under which Homer can speak. There's a second woman, a second feminine image, who ensures the precision of his seeing. Calliope ensures the power of his vision. But there's another feminine mythic image who ensures his precision. And that's Athena. Calliope allows you to sing in the epic, but Athena guarantees that what you sing of is true. So right away, hidden here in the first few lines of the Odyssey, Homer, without saying anything at all, puts the road signs up. If a man cannot see willingly through the eyes of these universal feminines, he's not going to be able to know what the story is about at all, on any scale or to any degree. Now you can see why Homer was the foundation of Greek civilization. More next week. Thank you.